Good morning. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey.
And you're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.FM. That is 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 100.7 in Corvallis, and on the web, KBOO.FM.
Absolutely, in the ether. And today, well, today is partly cloudy, very foggy, but still warm. And what does that mean? It means it invites thought. Any day invites thought.
It does.
I'm hedging the bets, you know.
Okay. And regardless of the weather, wherever you are, we're glad that you are here joining us this morning. Joining us this morning is Andrew Potter, who is the author of The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves.
Well, if we find ourselves.
If we find ourselves. I guess mm-hmm. that's the eternal search. Mr. Potter is the author. He grew up in Ontario. He has degrees from University of Toronto in philosophy. Currently, he is a columnist with Maclean's magazine. He is also the co-author of the book you may be familiar with, The Rebel Cell, called Nations of Rebels Here in the United States. He co-authored that with Joseph Heath.
Good morning. Good morning, Andrew. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Okay. Very fine. Just fine. You know, I'd almost ask you, are you sure you are yourselves? Are we not ourselves?
Am I sure I'm myself? I think so.
Well, the only reason I ask that is just the interesting idea of human beings on what they think is a fresh quest for meaning, personal integrity, et cetera, et cetera. And how sometimes we get confused along the way with trying to figure out ourselves from whatever. I won't say the hole in the wall. I want to say that so bad. So the authenticity hoax. Here we are in this day, this age, and we think maybe we've lost sight of who we really are, so we go on a search for it. But if one picks up your book and takes a little bit of a look, we realize maybe that's not exactly what we're doing. Maybe the whole idea of trying to find ourselves has kind of mutated into something else. Instead of it being a search for personal integrity or internal and external alignment, it's become perhaps a new form of consumerism, maybe?
Yeah, what I sort of argue is that I begin with the observation that the search for the authentic, or the search for authenticity, search for happiness or meaning or what have you in the search for the authentic, has become the dominant spiritual quest of our time. And you can sort of see that everywhere, from the search for, from the fetish for organic or local foods, to ecotourism, to all kinds of other things. And what I end up arguing is that while that quest is actually well motivated, that there are very good reasons why we sort of are searching for something authentic, what I end up arguing is that we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot, in the sense that the ways in which we're searching for the authentic, we end up exacerbating the very forms of consumerism or status competition or what have you that we're trying to avoid in the first place. So I kind of argue that the search for the authentic, as it sort of manifests itself in the West right now, is a bit of chasing rainbows. It's something that's going to keep receding if we keep on this path.
So let's start with a working definition of authentic, at least as you have posed it in the book, and the way we currently are manifesting authenticity.
Yeah, that's a good place to start, I think, because authenticity is one of those words that it's not really self-defining. Everyone sort of seems to think they know what it means, but everything is in a sense authentic if you just mean it is what it is. And so we need to figure out what we mean. And so if you're talking about the search for the authentic, you need to ask as opposed to what.
Exactly.
What I argue is that once you sort of unpack the way the word is used and the sort of circumstances when it's invoked, what it shows is that what people are looking for is a refuge of some sort from various aspects of the modern world, the market economy, excessive capitalism and consumerism. They're looking for a refuge or a substitute for secularism, the idea that we live in a world that is no longer enchanted or spiritually meaningful. So we're looking for a substitute for religion, and also technology, the increasing colonization of our minds and our time and our attention by Facebook and Twitter and the internet and TV and radio and everything like that. We look for sort of ways out of that. And so as it tends to get used, the search for the authentic tends to be either in opposition to or some kind of a refuge from technology, markets, and the lack of meaning we see around us, the alienation we feel in the sort of modern world.
I know that you've referenced certain philosophers such as Rousseau in both your research and illustrating how we've progressed. But it was really interesting when I started reading your book, what came to mind for me right in the introduction, oddly enough, was Aldous Huxley in Brave New World. And what I saw perhaps was this interesting contrast and comparison in which we were both retreating from the conditions that led to the Brave New World and then flailing in those same conditions.
That's really interesting. I hadn't sort of thought. I mean, it's funny. I read Huxley so long ago in school, and hadn't thought to invoke that. But you're right. A lot of what we're trying to retreat from is this Brave New World sense of I guess the term they use in that book is Fordism, right? The sort of mass production of everything around us. But what I liked about Rousseau and why I sort of invoked Rousseau is, Rousseau's critique of the modern world is extremely familiar to us, even though he was writing over 250 years ago. Because what I like about what Rousseau says is that the problems we have is not within us. Like, he doesn't say there's anything wrong with human beings as we are. The problems is with society itself. We become deformed by civilization. And so for Rousseau, it isn't even capitalism that's the problem. For him, the problem is just simply society itself, and the status competition and the jockeying for position that involves. And so for him, any attempt at becoming more authentic, at discovering your true self, requires basically retreating from civilization and becoming more natural. And I guess to take it back to Huxley and Brave New World, that's sort of the myth of the noble savage you get in that book, which is sort of held up as the same sort of story, I guess you're pointing out, right? That the savage becomes deformed within our society.
Well, not just that. Just the fact that as a theme through many of Huxley's books, it was this pitfalls that were created by society being controlled by science, by technology, by politics, and how that can reduce human individuality. But at the same time, when I think of, as you say, in The Noble Savage, I remember in the book there were the tours to the Savage Reservation. And then I think about in your book and in other articles I've read, people take these, what they call these authenticity tours, where they might go tour what the poor people in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, for example, you know, so they can see realness, you know, as if grit and grime and suffering is somehow more authentic than the comfortable life we live now.
That's really interesting. You're sort of bringing me back to the book now, and it's funny you should mention the tours, the Tenderloin District, because that's something that I find increasingly disturbing about the sort of the authenticity mongering that's sort of going on. I mean, it's one thing to sort of search for the authentic in sort of maybe an ecotourism trip to Nepal or Costa Rica, but you're right. There's these Tenderloin trips, and as far as I can tell, that's a way of San Francisco becoming in competition with what's going on in Los Angeles, which is you can take gangland tours of South Central LA, where they'll take you around and point out, you know, old former gangbangers will point out, you know, where they dealt drugs or where someone they knew got shot and so on. And it's this romanticization of poverty and of lack of development that is one of the more distasteful aspects of the sort of search for the authentic.
We're speaking this morning with Andrew Potter, author of The Authenticity Hoax. It occurred to me, Mr. Potter, as I listened to you, to remind myself that the search for wholeness or meaning is certainly not new and certainly did not originate with Mr. Rousseau. And when you were talking about the retreat for modernity, I was reminded of those in the 3rd and 4th century who concerned about the fall of Rome, left and went into the desert and became monks. So how is this search for authenticity or meaning or retreat from the eras of the modern world differ from what humanity has exercised in previous generations and cultures?
That's a really good question. I was actually sort of challenged on that a while ago. Someone sent me a passage from Seneca, the Stoic philosopher from, I guess, sort of just around the time of the birth of Christ. And Seneca has this great passage where he makes very similar arguments about to the ones I make in my book about modernity, where he talks about people traveling from one city to another. They go to one city in search of, cosmopolitanism. They go to another place in search of quiet. They go somewhere else in search of poverty, somewhere else in search of riches. And Seneca says at the end, he says, you know, what happens if what we're looking for is actually, within ourselves? We're looking for escape from ourselves is what we're actually trying to do. And he ends up by saying, you know, every man seeks to escape himself, but, never really succeeds. So that does sort of challenge, whether I'm sort of getting at something original in my diagnosis. I do think there is something that has changed, that did change with the move to modernity, which is that the main one being, I think, the triumph of secularism. I think that more than anything, the idea that the world no longer held a sort of an independent source of meaning we could all participate in. I think what that did was it really drove the search for meaning inward, where we could no longer find satisfaction out there in any sort of collective endeavors. It had to be driven inward into search for the creative powers of the self and more sort of individualist forms of authentic seeking, which I think that individualism is a problem, because I think that's what exacerbates a lot of the consumerism that we see out there.
And I want you to explore that more, because I think that's a very important point in terms of the rise of secularism. But before, I want to know, in terms of whether or not this is a uniquely Western phenomenon,
yes.
Whether or not this is a post-Christian, post-modernism, and related to that, when we have the so-called class of cultures, how is it manifested?
That's a good question. And it's one I don't have a firm answer. In fact, I've actually sort of put out feelers asking people who are sort of more familiar with other cultures, especially Asian cultures, whether you get these sorts of same dynamics. I don't have a solid answer. I do think that the story I tell about the fall of man as he or we move into the modern world has a distinctly biblical flavor to it. That the story Rousseau tells is pretty much a retelling of the fall story, the original fall of man story in the Bible. And all he's done is sort of taken that story and transformed it into, instead of original sin, what we have is sort of the sin of civilization. And I do think, and I can't prove it, but I suspect that there's something about the Western way of seeing the world, our tradition, that leads us to feel a certain unease with the traditions, especially technology and markets, that we're uneasy about it, and we feel a certain sense of shame and unease in the modern world. In a way, I think Asians don't, but I can't prove that, and it's something worth exploring.
Well, I want to ask it from two perspectives. On one hand, I would say it would seem that your thought has it gets traction if you look at modern Japanese culture, mm-hmm. And then from the same side, I would say, do you find it in Canadian culture?
We definitely find it in Canadian culture. Canadians are in a lot of ways not much, almost in very few ways, very much different from Americans on a lot of this. And in fact, I don't know how familiar you are with certain critics, but Adbusters magazine, for instance, the well-known anti-consumerist magazine, is based in Canada. Naomi Klein, who famously wrote the book No Logo, the big critique of Western consumerism, is also Canadian. And so, if anything, Canadians are sort of leading the charge in a lot of this stuff. Japanese culture, it's something I'm completely unfamiliar with.
I won't claim to be an expert in it, but what I would do is I would cite some of the criticism I'd heard from some of my friends who were getting criticism from older family members, for example, who might be fascinated with aspects of the American West or of the reggae culture and seek to emulate aspects of that, and being told, well, you're not really being Japanese,
right.
as if somehow that search for rootedness and some type of channel to authenticity in another culture is betraying your own and therefore not authentic.
Right. That's really interesting. There's a very weird sort of dynamic going on amongst people I know, at any rate. You might be familiar with the book and the website Stuff White People Like.
Yes.
Which sort of makes fun of white people for doing everything from like camping to riding bikes and all this kind of stuff. And someone pointed out to me, they said, they sent me a note, and it didn't occur to me, but they sent me a note saying, in a lot of ways, your book is basically the theoretical underpinnings of that phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of this authenticity seeking is, or what you're sort of calling authenticity seeking in my book, is a very white person fetish. That it's the kind of thing that upper middle class, college educated, largely white people are on about. And I was struck by that because there was a very interesting article in the New York Times a few months ago, and it was about the problems they're having attracting ethnics to or non-whites at any rate to the national parks in the United States.
Yes,
in particular,
yes.
Blacks and mm-hmm. Hispanics don't really go. And so they were interviewing some people about trying to figure out why they didn't sort of spend a lot of time in national parks. And they talked to this one guy, a Mexican commentator, and he said, the big question we have is, what is it with white people and nature? Why are you guys so obsessed with camping, right? And so it does speak to the idea that there are sort of distinct cultural dynamics at work that sort of color the whole notion of whether the authentic is anything that we can sort of pin down in any firm way.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste. We're speaking with Andrew Potter, who is the author of The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves. If you'd like to join in the conversation and share your ideas or contest our ideas about what is an authentic life, how does one attain one, is it attainable, you can do that by dialing 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Or you can hit us up at moretalkradio@gmail.com.
Thank you for sharing and for writing this book and enabling us to begin to think and share our thoughts on this topic, Mr. Potter. I was hoping if you are able to share with us in terms of how this search for authenticity, it manifests itself in different arenas, social, political arenas. You write about
the metaphysical.
Your book touches upon many, many issues. So in terms of socially, how is this manifested and politically in terms of politics, for example?
Yeah, in politics, it was really interesting because I was in the middle of writing the book during the last American presidential election campaign. And I was kind of gratified because what emerged during that campaign was that it was basically a campaign between competing conceptions of authenticity. You had, on the one hand, you had Barack Obama, who was being praised for his, at the time, at any rate, for bringing a sort of a new post-racial, post-partisan authenticity to American politics. And the other side, you had John McCain, who was sort of known for being a real straight shooter, Mr. You know, what they call him, the straight shooting express or something like that. And you had Sarah Palin in particular, who she sort of countered Obama in particular with this sort of American heartland, you know, mom maverick moose hunting form of authenticity. And so it really struck me that what had occurred to me was that what constitutes authenticity for a lot of people really depends on where you're coming from, and especially with someone like you see that contrast with Palin, where in that famous first speech she gave at the Republican convention, where what she did was basically stand up and just insult people who live in cities, and she sort of insulted people who, you know, eat arugula and drink lattes and this kind of thing, which is exactly the kind of behavior that in the crowds that I sort of hang in, mm-hmm. that's considered the height of authenticity, mm-hmm. right? Eating organic mm-hmm. food and drinking like, you know, fancy coffee. Whereas for Sarah Palin, being truly authentic meant, you know, riding snowmobiles and moose hunting and being a hockey mom and staying away from all this sort of citified stuff.
Right.
And so it was kind of fascinating to see how what you got in the American political dynamic was basically this competing sense of who is more authentic and
yes.
on what terms.
Yes, I think that's fascinating in terms of your analysis, because I think it might be possible just perusing through your book to say that this authenticity hoax is something that is manifested in, say, one particular political philosophy or culture. And by your illustration of how it manifests itself in popular conservative culture as well as popular progressive culture, it's something deeper and that it requires us to search deeper in terms of who we are, in terms of as we search for meaning.
I think that's right, and I almost regret that the book came out before the rise of the Tea Party, because I think that would have helped really kind of
yes.
amplify the point you just made, which is that this isn't about criticizing the left or criticizing the right. It's about something deeper going on, and I still actually don't think I have a full handle on it. But what strikes me, and you guys can correct me, I'm a Canadian sort of looking on from outside, but that part of what the Tea Party is offering is a sort of their own interpretation of what it means to be an authentic American, going back to the Constitution, a certain reading of the Constitution, a certain reading of the relationship between the state and the people. And that what they're doing is really laying claim to an authentic definition of America that they see the federal government, in particular the Democrats, as violating or undermining.
Right. Excellent point. We have a couple of callers online. Let me turn to LJ. Good morning, LJ.
Good morning, you guys. Again, you guys have hit it out of the park. Thank you so much for this show. It's really exploring ideas that are pretty abstract, but extremely important. Okay, that being said, given the fact that the United States is, in truth and in fact, an imperial empire, right? There are things done that the imperial empire has done vis-a-vis, like, the war in Iraq, for example, and other things that have been done in our name, all right? And we subscribe to the culture of the imperial empire. Have we actually, as people, compromised our feelings of humanity to be members of this culture of imperial empire? And I certainly will take my answers off the air. And thank you so much for the show.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. Do you have a response?
Maybe you can help me with the question. So the question is whether America, in becoming an imperial empire with its adventures in, I guess, Iraq and mm-hmm. Afghanistan to a certain extent, is the question whether American has lost track of what's meaningful, or?
I'm not quite sure. I think he hung up too quickly. I thought he was speaking maybe even in terms of the idea of American exceptionalism, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. Well, what I would say is one of the topics I bring up at the end of the book is the old idea that Francis Fukuyama first sort of raised was the idea of the end of history, the idea that that came up in 1989, right. Fall of the Soviet Union, that democracy and the rule of law and consumerism, that was sort of the end point of human evolution. Mm-hmm. That was at the time seen as a very offensive by a lot of people, seen as an offensively imperialistic and triumphalist view of the world. And what I think gets forgotten is that Fukuyama himself was highly ambivalent about what he called the end of history. That especially in the original essay he wrote, not the book, but the original essay he wrote for the National Interest, I think, or Foreign Policy magazine, I can't remember where it was. But he said the end of history will be a very fraught time. That it will be a period where, it might turn out that humans just simply aren't satisfied by consumerism and voting. That it will be a time where there will be no more honor, no more pride, nothing worth living for. And as he says that a lot of places will strongly resist. That for all kinds of reasons, and we will risk falling back into all kinds of equally difficult things: nostalgia for empire, nostalgia for religion, nostalgia for communism, perhaps. And I think that's a lot of what's going on right now. And I think part of the problems that America's had in the last decade has not been because it set out to be an empire in a Machiavellian way, but simply that Americans sort of set out to sort of remake the world in a way they thought would just happen naturally, and it just simply hasn't. For a lot of the reasons Fukuyama highlighted, that the world is a much more recalcitrant place, and the end of history is not nearly as appealing for everyone, including Americans, as he might have thought 20 years ago.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a great topic. And thank you again. I would like to ask your guest if he is talking about authenticity in America in particular or in the rest of the world also. How do you feel about organized religion as an authentic entity? It seems to me that most of these religions can't wait to get Earth wiped out so we can all get to this mythical place. And I'm not going to go on an anti-church rant, but that's the gist I'm getting. And the more I've been around a lot of indigenous peoples, including a lot of American Indian friends, and they seem to have the more spiritual Earth connection right. Just as a matter of, if you'll forgive the phrase, spiritual common sense, that I'm real comfortable with the earth as my mother, rather than, and there's a spiritual connection to a higher all wisdom. But this, riding up to heaven on a horse and the virgin birth and all that stuff, I mean, they must think we're nuts.
So it seems like you have two questions. Yes. One in terms of...
I've got one more.
We've only got time for at least those two, Brian. Let's let him get to those two.
We ready to go?
Yeah. Yes.
Thanks. On the first question, I'm mostly talking about North America, but America in particular. Like I said, I'm a Canadian sort of looking in, but we partake much more robustly in American popular culture and social culture and politics than a lot of us like to admit. So I'm mostly talking about North America and what's going on here. With respect to organized religion, that's really interesting. One of the big surprises that I found in the way the book has been received is how well it's been received amongst religious people, religious reviewers, and religious blogs and websites and so on. And it took me a while to realize what was going on. And it's this, that what I'm criticizing in the book or saying is a bit of a hoax or sort of not working is the search for a replacement for religion in the form of the authentic. In the form of various forms of consumption or experience, like organic food or ecotourism and so on. And a lot of religious people have piped up and sort of said, see, we told you, right? We told you that religion was the only way of getting real meaning, and that all these secular attempts at substituting for religion are bound to fail. And I thought that was really surprising and intriguing, and I'm not sure what to make of it yet. But with respect to the question about whether indigenous beliefs offer a more sophisticated or robust form of authenticity, I'm a bit concerned by that for two reasons. One is that it leads to a certain kind of almost intellectual colonialism by white people who tend to look outside their own tradition and almost fetishize the belief systems of others. Mm-hmm. And what that can result in is a desire to treat other cultures almost like a zoo, where yes. you go and you sort of observe and sort of partake in it without actually totally completely understanding it. And I don't know what the situation is in the United States, but here in Canada, that's resulted in a bit of a problem, which is that our native communities are having a lot of difficulty managing the transition to the modern world. And it's very familiar. It's the same problem you see in Australia and other places, parts of the world. Mm-hmm. Aboriginal communities have a distinct difficulty. And I don't think we do them any favors by telling them that their authentic or their own old traditions are in some sense more authentic than anything else, and they need to be sort of flash frozen in those sorts of belief systems or cultural attitudes. I think they need to be allowed to manage the transition to the modern world on their own terms as best they can. And I don't think we do them any favors at all by sort of trying to tell them what they should keep, what they shouldn't, what's valuable and what isn't. So,
well, one of the things that I agree with you, one of the things I find interesting, though, is not only does it fetishize, but it really commodifies aspects of the culture and the mindset. And then people feel as though, their culture is being usurped or in some ways sucked up digested instead of appreciated as yet one more take on this thing called life and how humanity can respond to the awesome experience of living.
That's exactly right. I think that's an excellent way of putting it. One of the more interesting things that has happened in Canadian Native communities is they've adopted the symbols and signs of American hip-hop. So you get this sort of Native hip-hop trend which is coming up. And, I don't know whether it's good or bad, but I know I find it fascinating. I would be loath to sort of have a bunch of, Western white people sort of say, that's not your tradition. You shouldn't be doing that. But I think your point's exactly bang on.
Well, what's really interesting when we talk about the ability to synthesize and grow and create new avenues of human expression, hip hop is seen as a liberating force that is used by all people all around the world. So for folks to say that it's not authentic and it's not your culture, well, I'm thinking, as opposed to what? As opposed to the English and French, colonialists and imperialists that came over and imposed a rule on folks. But, it goes back to that initial question you said, what is authentic?
Right.
Let's get to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning, Joanne.
Yes, hello. I've been on a journey since maybe the 1970s of reclaiming myself and my life of what I understand it is, and I'm still not sure if I really understand it. But here's where I'm coming from. I have a lifelong, since 1960s, I have a history of psychiatric oppression, and I'm still in it. And I was wondering what you're talking about. Have any connection why we have such a high amount of mental illness of all kinds and alcoholism and psychiatric drugs and other drugs. And I don't know how much, there's more to say or ask, but I don't have the energy. And thank you.
Hey, thank
all
you,
right, thank
Joanne.
You for your question.
Excellent.
Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
No. Respond in terms of her concerns and in terms of the search for authenticity and in terms of medicine, the rise in psychiatry, people going for counseling. How is this all related in terms of search for authenticity?
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those areas where I didn't write much about it in the book, partly out of just a lack of ability and lack of deep knowledge on the field and so on. I do know that it's often a stat you hear quite a bit is that America has one of the highest rates of mental illness in the world, if not the highest. I think to a certain extent that's because Americans have become a lot more comfortable talking about it than other countries. I think in a lot of countries, mental illness is still stigmatized a lot more than it is in the United States. But what I find interesting about a lot of the uses of not just drugs like what am I talking about here? Prozac and so on. Mm-hmm. But also the whole gamut of forms of medicalized searches for our true self, trying to sort of everything from the use of Botox to the use of Viagra to the use of other forms of like Viagra Prozac and so on, is that when we talk about this, we're not talking about making ourselves different from what we are. We're talking about trying to make ourselves who we truly feel we are, who we truly feel ourselves to be. And so what I'm getting at is this idea that the medicalization of our unhappiness is caught up itself in the language of authenticity, that what we're trying to do is get towards who we really feel we deep down truly are. We're not trying to sort of become other than we are. And I think that just speaks to the profound malaise of our time, which is that we're searching for something, and that we're willing to medicate ourselves, we're willing to cut ourselves, we're willing to poison our faces with Botox, all in the name of the search for something authentic. And I don't think that's entirely healthy.
Well, let me tease you right here and say, so how is that different from SOMA from Brave New World?
Uh-huh.
You know, even though one proposedly was to put you to sleep, it's not really much difference. I mean, is it putting you to sleep or is it waking you up, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the crucial question, right? And it's funny you should put it in those terms, because the putting you to sleep versus waking you up question, I mean, that's in Brave New World. It's also the essential dynamic of the movie The Matrix, right?
Yes.
You take a pill, and you're told you're actually being woken up, right? But the option is to take a pill that will keep you to sleep forever. And I think while on the one hand I'm tempted to say that that's the fundamental conundrum of our time, this question about whether we're watching TV and being on the internet and doing all these things in order to dull our senses, or whether we're trying to awake ourselves, I think it may be that the whole question is in a sense mal put, that this idea that in civilization we become in a sense blinded to the truth, and that only outside of the modern world can we see the truth. I think that in itself is a mistake. So I think this opposition between being bamboozled by the fake, by illusion, and we need to search to find an underlying reality, I think that is the quest for the authentic, and I think it's part of what's causing our problems, and it's not going to solve it.
I want to perhaps carry this on a little bit more. For those who've just joined us, we're speaking with Andrew Potter, who is the author of The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves. There's so much more to address than we have time for in this book. For example, I'm really interested in the conundrum that's posed by Rousseau's thought that civilization and the mask we have to wear are what causes us to lose ourselves, yet it's almost as though we want to some kind of way distance ourselves from the fact that we actually need to be around people, and that civilization is a natural outgrowth of human community, and that there ought to be some dynamic that causes us to be more real, and perhaps we're just blinded because it's right in front of our face.
So you're asking me whether actually in society we actually find something more real, or
well, maybe it's, you know, and what I like about it is you're saying perhaps we're asking the wrong questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, for example, just to be clear about what you mean by authenticity, we're not talking about discriminating tastes or the desire to have a better life that is free from poisons or free from negative influence, but we're talking about having a life that allows inner and external resonance, you know.
Right.
and being able to relate to each other in such a fashion. But I've only got a few minutes left. I want to make sure I relate properly to our callers who are hanging on. So I'll get back to that question in a moment.
Okay.
We'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Thank you, Mitchell, for holding. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Andrew. I was wondering if either of you have read any of the works of Lloyd Pye?
Lloyd Path?
Pye, P-Y-E.
P-Y-E, no, I'm not familiar with his work.
Well, okay. You know, part of our situation here, I think, is the misinformation that we're given as just people, not as a race or a creed or anything else, just people. I was confused yesterday. I got into a conversation about fluoride in water. And I was kind of told that it was really good for us and that it has nothing to do with our behavior or our health or our how the cancers and diseases have grown over the years and everything. I mean, our population, the humans, are being dumbed down one way or the other, and I was just questioning if maybe you knew something about the fluoride in the water or some of the other ingredients that they're putting in the water and also into the air.
Okay, thank you.
That's a really good question. I actually have fairly mainstream views on this. I think here in Canada right now, we've actually seen a number of public hysterias over a few things. One is fluoride in the water. A town here in Ontario actually recently banned it. A school in Ontario banned Wi-Fi at the schools because they thought it was poisoning the kids' brains. And there's also the ongoing dispute over vaccines. You might have heard of whether they give cause autism and so on. And I actually find a lot of these public hysterias kind of disturbing, because probably because I think they're not a problem to a large extent. And I think what they manifest is they're actually symptoms of this idea that a lot of people have that technology is poisoning our brains. Wow. And that these sorts of technologies or medical shifts are, in a sense, controlling our minds or serving to alienate us from who we truly are. And I worry about this because especially when it comes to something like vaccines or fluoride in the water, you only have to go back 40 or 50 years to a time when there were significant public health problems in North America. I don't know anybody who has polio, but my father does. I don't know anybody who got smallpox, but my grandfather did. And those are gone. Vaccines in particular is, this, as far as I can tell, the single greatest public health initiative of the last 50 to 60 years. And I get really anxious when I hear sort of people sort of worrying that this is somehow a conspiracy or part of an agenda, an industrial or government agenda to control our minds or to do anything like that.
But these concerns are directly related to the issues you raise in this book in terms of the search for authenticity, for something real. And it manifests itself in different ways, whether it's concern about public health, whether it's manifest about the how society is losing religion in many ways. So this search seems to continue. And I'm wondering if you are able, as we approach the end of our hour, to help direct us in terms of possible solutions.
Wow, that's the question I always dread.
Yeah.
Because because the book is in a sense a critique of a certain kind of search.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people ask me when I give talks and do interviews, I say, okay, well, so how do we be happy?
Do we find a real search or ask the right question?
Yeah, or how do we find the real search? And I think the answer is, to a certain sense, and if I'd had more time and sort of more knowledge, my original conclusion of the book I was working on, to a certain extent, adopted a much more Zen approach. Zen in a very sort of amiable, easygoing way. Nothing sort of hardcore about studying Buddhism or anything like that, but just this idea that because I think a lot of the problem, going back to Rousseau, is the idea that the problems we have comes out of status seeking, this idea that we're always comparing ourselves to one another. That's the problem. It's not so much technology, and it's not really markets. It's status seeking. And to the extent to which we can abstain from that, I think we'll be happier, we'll be more satisfied, and we'll find our true selves. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, and the fact that we some of us pride ourselves by not being status seekers is a way in which we seek status.
Yes. It's like anti-status seekers.
That's exactly right. And I mean, and that's exactly right. And to a large extent, the search for the authentic is just a disguised form of status seeking. It's, you know, you're trying to show how much you don't care about all kinds of things, how much you don't care about consumerism, how much you don't care about the world around you. But that itself admits of degrees and admits of one-upmanship and forms of jockeying for position. And so I think to a large extent, we can only be happy, or we can only really truly find who we really are once we sort of achieve that sort of clarity of mind about who we are outside of worrying about what other people think, what other people are doing, and how we look in the eyes of others. That's a very, very difficult thing. And, if I had the answer, I would have written a very different book. But I don't.
Okay. We'll look for the next book when you have the answers.
Yes.
In the meantime, we'll go to our next Michael, who's on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I've been listening to all this foolishness this morning. Let me break a couple of things down. First of all, the only true authority out here on authenticity is the Word of God. I mean, let's just be for real. And according to the Word of God, man's knowledge is foolishness when it's compared to God. So what I've been listening to this morning is foolishness. Man is basically dirt. Let's don't put man... make man any more important than what he is. You wear some clothes in a day or two, you're going to recognize that you're dirt. So what you need to be realizing on man is you got to deal with his spirit and his soul. That's the only thing that's important out here.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
Any thoughts on that? Any ideas or comments, Andrew?
My only comment would be that you can frame the entire discussion as a sort of a hypothetical, right?
Mm-hmm.
Given that we live now in a world where a lot of people no longer buy into that sort of way of looking at the world, is there a way of finding the true self, finding the authentic self? So you frame the whole discussion as a hypothetical. In a secular age, what would you do? That doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong, the caller's wrong. It just means that that's no longer a convincing way for a lot of people looking at the world. And so the question becomes all that more pressing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it seems that one of the things that causes this status seeking manifested by this authentic is what I mean to say, one-upmanship is a loss of a sense of awe. It's as though we can't be in awe of something and recognize that there are certain concepts or certain existential beings or states that are bigger than us and that we can't necessarily comprehend, but they don't do us any damage, and they help us kind of put us in context with the rest of the world, so to speak.
You know, I love that comment. I caught a very interesting debate here in Toronto a few months ago between Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, and Christopher Hitchens, the atheist columnist.
Uh-huh.
And the debate was on the topic of whether religion is a force for good or evil in the world. Blair saying it was a force for good, Hitchens saying it was a force for evil. And one of the most interesting points that Blair made, and actually Hitchens made it for him, but Blair made, was that if there's one thing that can be said for religion or a religious view of the world over a secular view, it's that religion has done a better job than just about anything, any sort of worldview, of bringing us in touch with the numinous, bringing us in touch with the ecstatic or the sense of awe for something beyond us.
Mm-hmm.
And that the great challenge of secular society is that it hasn't produced a form of art, it hasn't produced a form of music that mm-hmm. does nearly as good a job of bringing us in touch with the ecstatic dimension of life as religion has. And perhaps that ultimately is where more secular-minded people should be looking. Not in organic produce, not in foreign cultures, but in a form of art that does that.
Very good. Let's go to our last caller. Debbie, thank you for waiting.
Hi.
Hi, yes, you're on the air.
I don't exactly know what you guys are talking about. I was calling to ask for a phone number.
Okay, well,
we'll turn you over to the engineer. Sorry. All righty. Well, that gives us a little extra minute then to kind of wrap it up. And I want to try to clarify once again, when we're talking about authenticity, as you pose it in the book, we're not talking about, again, that, well, we kind of are, but we're not saying whether or not you are true to yourself, you have that internal and external integrity and alignment with behavior. We're talking about whether or not you look down upon people who use regular light bulbs and you carry an iPod, or whether you want to spend $700 on a pair of jeans just because they look like the very ones that were worn by miners, or whether you think that beating your clothes on a rock to get them clean actually makes you more superior because you don't use one of those new eco washing machines.
Right. Well, I think we are sort of talking about them both because, and maybe this sort of connection isn't made as clear as I should have in the book, but I think what happens is we end up in that second form of degenerate authenticity seeking, largely because the first kind has some sort of built-in problems with it. And I think the built-in problem with trying to sort of bring who you deep down are in alignment with who you sort of, the face you present the world, that sort of alignment of inner and outer, the problem with that is that it's hard to know who you really are outside any judgments of what you like, how you want to be, where you want to go. And once you sort of start making those judgments, in our society, you end up making judgments about your taste. And once you start making judgments about your taste, you get into sort of a consumerist sort of dialogue. And so the slope isn't completely greased, but it is somewhat slippery. And the challenge, I think, for anyone who sort of is trying to sort of find out who they truly are, without reference to consumer culture, is that it's something very difficult to do in the society in which we live.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew Potter, for being with us this hour. I want to remind our listeners that you are the author of The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves, published by HarperCollins. And thank you for joining us this morning and sharing us your thoughts and helping us along this journey.
And we hope to visit you again sometime in the future. And by the way, you do have a blog where people can read more of your writing.
I do. It's authenticityhoax.squarespace.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And you have been listening to More Talk Radio with Celeste and myself, Cecil. Let me remind you that coming up at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Bill Resnick talks with David Gipass, president of the National Lawyers Guild, about whether the U.S. lives up to the standards it applies to China. At 10 is Air Cascadia. Hear news, headlines, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with organ farmer Frank Morton, who is suing Monsanto and the USDA over genetically engineered sugar beet. He'll talk about the recent court decision ordering the immediate uprooting of 256 acres of genetically engineered beets in Oregon and Arizona. At 11 on Sound of Awareness, host Paul Van Dyke speaks with Lani Duville, the world's longest surviving quadriplegic. And at 11:30, host Ed Goldberg speaks with D.K. Holm and Mark Mohan about Far From Hollywood, an association of film critics, and their 2011 awards to be announced at the Hollywood Theater on Friday.
Excellent. So stay tuned to KBOO.FM and KBOO 90.7. After all, we are your community connection, and we'll hear you next week.